sugar. I call my baby my sugar. I never made me my sugar, because my sugar is so confectionary funny. She never asks for my money. All I can give her is honey that she can get anytime. I'd make a million trips to her lips if I was a bee, 'cause she's sweeter than any candy to me. She's brand new day sugar. I never cheat on my sugar, 'cause I'm so sweet on my sugar, that sugar baby of mine.
Louis Armstrong singing Sugar. My name is Danny Miller. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross. This week in Anaheim, California, home of Mickey Mouse and Disneyland, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has held its national annual convention. Last night, there was an awards dinner at which Terry Gross accepted an award on behalf of Fresh Air, which he has hosted and produced for over 5 years, and which received first prize in the live radio category for the 1981 CPB Awards. WUHY's news director Nick Peters was also there to accept an award on behalf of the 91 Report news staff, WUHY's news magazine, which won first place honors in the Spot News Coverage category for a story on the disruption of a city council meeting last April by John Street. 91 Report also earned an honorable mention in the regularly scheduled newscast category, the only show in the CPB Awards of this year to win both a first prize and an honorable mention. Also, an honorable mention was made for the WUHY special, A Tribute to Samuel Barber, which was produced by WUHY's program director Fred Landrell and hosted by former WUHY music director Terry Payton. And last but not least, WUHY's general manager Bill Seemring was also honored at the awards ceremony last night by NPR president Frank Mankiewicz for his role in creating and developing NPR's All Things Considered, which will be celebrating its 10th anniversary this Monday. In all, out of over 200 submitting stations, WUHY was given 4 honors, the highest number for any one station, and was the only station to win 2 first prizes in the 13 submission categories. We're, of course, around here very happy about this, especially Terry Gross, as the occasion has given her a chance to visit Disneyland and hang out with Mickey and, of course, Minnie Mouse, which she's probably doing right now. Well, on with the show. About a year ago, jazz pianist and composer Jackie Byard came to Philadelphia to tape a special music workshop and interview with Terry Gross. He sat at the piano for about 2 hours, drawing from every style and era of jazz piano, including stride, swing, bebop, and contemporary playing, and demonstrating the influences of the classical avant-garde piano literature of the early 20th century on his playing. He also discussed his experiences working with other great jazz players, which have included Charles Mingus, Eric Dolphy, and Razan Roland Kirk. We heard part one of this special program yesterday on Fresh Air. We'll hear part two today at 4 o'clock, which will conclude with a special concert of solo piano. That'll be today at 4 o'clock, Jackie Byard. Every Friday at 3:30, Fresh Air's film critic Bill Van Wert reviews a film and previews the upcoming week of movies to be shown on television. Today, Bill will review the film Excalibur. At about 3:10, I'll be speaking with Charles Higham, who was the Hollywood correspondent for the New York Times for over 10 years. He has interviewed over 200 movie stars, directors, and cameramen, and has written several film biographies, but none as controversial as his most recent biography on Errol Flynn, which alleges that Flynn was a Nazi sympathizer and collaborator. We'll hear from Charles Higham about the Hollywood beat and his biography of Errol Flynn at about 3:10. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by saxophonist and composer Oliver Lake, who's in Philadelphia to play tonight at Haverford College, 8 p.m. in Roberts Hall. I'll be giving a phone number for that in a moment. He'll be featured with his latest band, Jump Up, which consists of two electric guitars, electric bass, and drums. Jump Up's sound has been described as being similar to the funk and new music orientation of the Primetime Band led by Ornette Coleman, or the different groups led by James Blood Ulmer. Before we meet Oliver Lake, let me give you a phone number for more information for tonight's concert. That's 896-6606. It's 896-6606. And before we do meet Oliver Lake, I wanted to play a selection from one of his records. It's not the type of funk-oriented music that he'll be playing tonight, but it's an earlier type of music that he's been playing off of an album called Life Dance of Is. This is an Oliver Lake composition called Change One. Thank you. Change One, an Oliver Lake composition off of his album Life Dance of Is, and that was written by Oliver Lake and featured Oliver on alto and soprano sax and vocals. Michael Gregory Jackson was playing electric guitar and harmonica and was shouting in the background. Anthony Davis was playing piano and organ, Leonard Jones on bass, and Farin Akhlaf on drums and tambourine. And I'm joined right now by Oliver Lake. He is in town to play a concert tonight at Haverford College, and that's at 8 p.m. in Roberts Hall on the Haverford campus. And there's a number for more information and directions. That's 896-6606. Oliver Lake has played for many years with members of the avant-garde in jazz, including Julius Hempel, David Murray, and Hammett Blewett, with whom he performed in the World Saxophone Quartet. His early work was based in St. Louis, where he was a guiding force in the Black Artists Group, a collective of poets, musicians, and dancers formed in the late 60s. Shortly after that, he studied arranging and composition with Oliver Nelson and Ron Carter. In the early 70s, he met Anthony Braxton while on a tour of Europe and soon was recording with him. Oliver Lake's work has also included composition of dance and theater music, film scoring, and poetry, and he's toured the United States, Canada, Europe, and Japan with his own groups, with the World Saxophone Quartet, and as a solo artist. Again, Oliver Lake will be appearing tonight as part of the alternative concert series of Haverford and Bryn Mawr College with his newest band, Jump Up. They'll be playing at 8 p.m. in Roberts Hall on the Haverford campus, and for further information or directions, you can call 896-6606. Welcome to Fresh Air, Oliver.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in today. And since I've introduced you, at least as part of your past as being an avant-garde musician, what is an avant-garde musician? And what does that label or tag imply, at least these days?
Well, right now, for me, avant-garde musician, I really don't know what it means from that standpoint. From another standpoint of translation, it's a French term meaning ahead of its time. I personally don't think I'm ahead of my time. I think that's a way of the media and maybe various other people in the music business. It may be a way for them not to actually deal with you right now. So they say, so something they don't want to deal with, they call it avant-garde. Right now, I consider the music that I play contemporary. I consider that I'm contemporary. I'm right now. I'm not past now. I'm now. So a lot of people don't deal with things that are labeled avant-garde because they figure, well, it's past me. I don't really want to deal with it, so they don't get into it. And a lot of times the music will be right on it. It'll be right on it. It'll be right now. And that label takes people somewhere else.
Well, because, as you said, it means, or people react to it as in the future and don't have to deal with it right now. The avant-garde is sometimes, or probably most of the time, seen in like a historical progression from, for instance, in jazz, there's early jazz and the middle periods of jazz, and then you have the avant-garde. And if you see it in that type of progression, or if you assume it in that type of progression, then it's possible also to assume that after the present avant-garde has been around for a few years, it will later come into the mainstream. What do you think of that type of a...
Well, historically, that's what's happened. I mean, when Charlie Parker came on the scene in the 40s, his music was labeled avant-garde, and now it's considered mainstream. The music that is called bebop is now considered mainstream, and myself and some other musicians that I've played with and known over the years are considered in this area that's called avant-garde. But you see, the labels have a tendency to keep us divided, and it stops us from dealing with each other. It becomes convenient in America to have labels so everybody knows what to buy and you know what's in the can and you know all of that, But in reality, you have a tendency to... It doesn't make things work very clearly. It keeps us divided, as I said before, and I don't think that they're very good.
Is there any positive attachment to having a label, though? Because after all, it does help define you. There are certain assumptions you can make when you're labeled. Maybe they're incorrect, but maybe there are some correct assumptions about what you might expect from somebody who is labeled an avant-garde musician. Is there anything positive?
Well, obviously, there has to be some positive in everything for me. I mean, one thing can't be all negative, but as I said before, I think the labels have a tendency to keep people from each other and to keep a division there. There are some people who might have a blanket thing against a certain label, And they may miss some very good music just because of that label. If they read something in the paper and suppose it says trance music, and this person says, oh, I don't like trance music. But the person that they're going to hear may be very, very good, and they may have enjoyed it, but they miss it because of that label. As the same, they could miss avant-garde. It's avant-garde, or I want something that's happening now. I don't want to deal with something in the future. So consequently, they miss a concert because I'm labeled by some writer or somebody who knows nothing about the music. So it has positives because you have to know when you go in a record store or something, if you're buying some, did you get an idea from that label that's given to it? But in reality, they're not very good. I don't get as upset with them as I used to years ago. I've learned that they're going to find a label for you regardless of what you do. So I stopped letting it take my adrenaline up. So it doesn't really bother me that much anymore because I find they're going to put a name on it. I don't care what it is, man.
When that label was used in, let's say, the early 60s when you were in St. Louis, does it mean anything different from what it means now, just in terms of the type of stereotype it might be describing?
Well, see, it makes it very difficult for me to discuss because I'm not really into labels. And I'm into just creating music and trying to share the music with people and performance. So I can't really speak on how the labels have changed and how they've affected this and how they've done that because I've tried to stay away from them. I think it's healthier.
Who do you think? Who is your audience? Can you define that? I mean, is that something? We might be falling back into labels again, but
no.
How would you define the group of people that listen to your music?
Well, from the places that I travel, it seems to be the age group seems to be between, say, maybe 17, 18 years old up to about 35, something like that. The majority of the people. I mean, there are people from all ages that come, but that seems to be the bulk of the people that are listening to the music. Maybe college students might be a big portion of the audience.
Do you have a sense of what other type of music they listen to? Again, labels.
Based on AM radio and based on record sales, I have a sense. I know that one of the very large rock groups, whoever they are, I can't call their name. I'm sure they sell a million albums, so they're probably listening to Kiss. According to what's on the radio, AM radio, I think maybe over 90% of the people listen to AM, and on AM radio you have Kiss and other things. So I guess they're listening
to that. Okay, because that's certainly a different description of a group that listens to you than you would expect, let's say, thinking back to the early 70s and with the label of avant-garde jazz musician, you wouldn't think that your audience would be the same audience as the one that's buying Kiss albums or listening to AM radio.
Well, I don't know if it's the same, but I know in terms of age-wise, maybe between 17 and 35 might be the bulk of the age group that comes to hear concerts that I perform.
Are you confronted with... Well, people in the audience being mystified by what you're doing, is it a type of music that is learned to be appreciated?
Well, basically, most of the people I play in several different contexts. You know, as you mentioned before, from solo context and where I'm doing poetry to the World Saxophone Quartet, which is four saxophones, to a quintet of piano, bass, and drums, and trumpet, and myself, and to the group that I'm playing with tonight, which is Jump Up. And all four of those situations are very different musically, I think. You know, so most of the people are familiar with the work that I've done, and they come, so they're not really surprised that much. You know, and they kind of know what they're coming to hear. People who wander in, and they may be kind of like wondering what's happening, maybe.
Yeah,
but I don't think they would wonder. They would be in a mysterious way if they walked in on Jump Up, because the piece that you played earlier was an obvious reggae piece, and that's some of the things that we
mm-hmm.
do in Jump Up.
Mm-hmm. Is there a very different audience, though, that might come to a World Saxophone Quartet concert from a Jump Up concert?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think if the listeners are as objective and open as I would hope they would be, they can get into both sounds.
Here comes another label. How do mainstream musicians react to your music?
The musicians, I deal with how they react just as from musician to musician or as from person to person and not necessarily what style they've been associated with. And I think that's the way they relate to me, and just in terms of a musician and from a musicianship standpoint, you know, they know that as I know that they've studied their instruments and know what they're doing, and we're still studying, and it's just from a professional level. It's not from a level of what area of you're in. It's just based on professionalism. Just how would you be responded to by a newscaster or a radio person on AM? Or is this an FM station?
It's right. FM. But
okay, so what's the difference in an FM or AM? How would they respond to you?
Well,
you
know, because...
I'm giving that analogy to say that basically it's from a professional standpoint, it's really good.
Right, but one of the things about all of the arts is that people in them sometimes have preset conceptions about, mm-hmm. Either what is correct or what is, what's the right approach. And what, you know, I mean, frankly, people just say, well, that's noise, that's not music. Mm-hmm. You know, and where do people come up with those distinctions? How have they applied?
Okay, you know, like I was responding to your question on a personal level. On a personal level, it's from a very professional response. On a general level, there may be some musicians who are associated with other labels would consider what some of the musicians who are labeled avant-garde would consider what they're doing as noise and not music. Of course that happens. And as I said before, to me that just illustrates how the labels keep us divided. You have the bebop musician against the rock musician against the new wave musician against the funk musician. And it doesn't mean anything because it's still music. It's all the same thing, all from the same source. A source being much higher than either you or than I. You and I mean, it's from a spiritual source, which is a source of music. So, I mean, when you get very general about it, it all winds up being the same thing. And all those labels, they just disappear.
We were talking earlier about how Charlie Parker was the thought of as the avant-garde of his day, and now he's thought of as being a very important but mainstream from a mainstream school of playing. But if we accept that right now there is, well, let's say the type of music you're playing, which is labeled avant-garde, but it's for you the music of now. That is nevertheless apart from most of the jazz which is played these days. Mm-hmm. How do you feel that your music is going to be filtered into the mainstream?
The same way it is now. I mean, it's the fact that I'm doing the interview, the fact that I'm doing a concert, and the fact that I'm traveling all over the world playing, and other musicians who are in the same category of music that I'm playing in are doing the same thing. And if they... put the music on, say, television more often and AM radio more often, it wouldn't sound so-called avant-garde or so-called ahead of its time, whatever.
Very
normal.
Can you hear things in which, things that you might have been thinking about or playing, a few years ago now being reflected in other players, but... players that which certainly would not be considered to be in the category of music which you're playing?
Oh, I think definitely. I mean, all musicians are influenced by other musicians, and consequently you hear some things that you've done and coming up in some areas that you wouldn't normally expect, you know. So, yes, it happens all the time.
Sure. Can you give some examples either... in terms of maybe, technical or aesthetic horizons that have been opened up that were closed because they didn't seem to be appropriate for most of the type of music that was being played at the time until somebody came along and investigated that type of playing?
Well, I don't know how to deal with it, but if you just look at the thing of Chuck Berry and the Beatles and that whole thing, you know. They got really into Chuck Berry, and they did it. And Elvis Presley, he was really into Chuck Berry, and he did it. And same thing happens. I mean, there are musicians who listen to Charlie Parker and they copy him verbatim, and it transfers into some of. There's more bebop being played now, so-called bebop being played in the rock bands now than ever before, because musicians are much better than they were 15, 20 years ago, because they're going. I mean, the music is being taught now in the universities. So you have maybe 100, 200, 300 tenor saxophone players who can quote John Coltrane verbatim, and they're learning that in the universities. So that didn't exist 20 years ago. So, of course, that music's going to turn up everywhere, you know. And that's the way it has been. I mean, musicians borrow. They borrow, and, you know, it's very important, the work that the black musicians have done in America.
Well, in your playing, I think I can hear something that which you've borrowed, and from your earlier days of playing with some R&B bands down in St. Louis, and I also read that you spent some time just going around and wanting to meet R&B musicians, and you've also mentioned that Al Green and Wilson Pickett are important to you, among other singers. How did R&B come in and influence your playing, or how does it?
Well, you know, it's all a part of one thing for me. It's all a part of my musical being, man. You know, I've heard the music since very small, you know, and as I said before, I'm not really separating it. Consequently, I'm listening to everything, and I'm being influenced by everything that I listen to, you know. So basically, that's how it is. I played in the bands that did the songs of the R&B singers, and I've played with some of them, So it's just a part of one continuous thing, man, really. I'm just in a continuum of black musicians in America who are just trying to continue in the same spirit as Eric Dolphy and John Coltrane and Charlie Parker, that of being searching to try to continue with the music, you know. That's all. And that's all the music that's been called jazz, all the musicians have been doing throughout the years. And throughout the years, each section of the music has been labeled Dixieland, jazz, rock, gospels, blues. But basically, it's all the same thing from that one source, you know. And we're just moving through that continuum. And I'm on that continuum, so I have to borrow from what happened before me. And there it is.
Well, let's listen to something which you composed and recorded in about 1975 from your album Heavy Spirits. We're going to listen to Movement Equals Creation, which is with violins, which you wrote for and yourself. Is there anything you'd like to say about the recording before we hear it?
No.
Okay, let's hear it. This is featuring Oliver Lake from his record Heavy Spirits, and the name of his composition is Movement Equals Creation.
Thank you.
That was Movement Equals Creation, and featuring Oliver Lake. It was his composition. And Oliver Lake is in town tonight to play at Haverford College at a concert, and that'll be in Roberts Hall at 8 p.m. tonight. And here's a phone number for further information. That's 896-6606. 896-6606. Oliver, you had studied with Ron Carter and Oliver Nelson, and what were you studying with them?
They were teaching one summer in St. Louis, where I'm from, at the university there, teaching composition. And I studied composition with Oliver Nelson, and with Ron Carter, it was a performance class. So we were playing tunes and studying structure of tunes, etc.
How would Oliver Nelson approach composition? I mean, would it be, I don't think it would be like how somebody at, like a classical conservatory would approach composition, but I'd imagine there would be some overlap. What was his approach?
Well, basically the class that I had with him was composing for a big band, traditional big band setup, you know, five trumpets, five sax, etc. And we, you know, the goal of the class was to create a composition and have it performed. And he just critiqued it, and you played parts of it, and he looked at it and gave you different ideas on what to do, etc.
Okay, now what we just heard was not at all like what you write for big band, but
no.
Any insights that you gathered from Oliver Nelson or from that type of writing that you could apply to something like this?
Well, see, the thing, all of my experiences compositionally and musically are used when I'm composing. So I don't just, you know, I draw from all the experiences, musical experiences for composition. But basically, when I composed that piece, I was dealing with three violins, and I was trying to, it was actually the first pieces I had composed for violins. And I was really trying to get into that. So I was doing a lot of studying on my own and talking to violin players in St. Louis and et cetera, getting how to compose for the violin.
Was there any coaching that you wanted to do as a composer to the players playing, to the violinists? It isn't the type of literature that they might have done a lot of before, so perhaps there might have been something that you wanted to translate for them or something.
The biggest problem doing that was just the attitudes of some of the people, you know, because, again, I wasn't known as a classical, so quote-unquote, composer, so a lot of the players may have had an attitude and really questioned the music that I had written. So the biggest part of getting the piece done was dealing with their attitudes. And after that was melted, we played the piece and it was no problem.
Do you write for strings? Have you been writing for strings recently?
Recently, I've been doing duo concerts with Leroy Jenkins, who is a violinist and viola player. And matter of fact, we did a concert last night. And that's the only writing for strings that I've done recently.
Because I was wondering, like, if you were to write a string quartet, for instance, if you would have to, living in New York, have to, you know, perhaps go to Juilliard or some classical grouping of musicians, or if there's now a group of string players which already is tapped into your type of writing.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. It's no problem to get the string players in New York. I've done several programs with strings and had these pieces performed in performance with the Brooklyn Philharmonic. Harmonic and the string players now, it's no problem for them to read this music. They're familiar with contemporary writing today.
How did you feel playing, having your pieces performed with the Brooklyn Philharmonic?
I felt great. Yeah. Anytime I can get my written pieces performed, it's wonderful. And if they do a good reading, and they were excellent musicians, so I felt very good about it.
Did you do much talking with the players in the orchestra, in the Philharmonic, the Brooklyn Philharmonic?
Oh, yes, I had to rehearse with them in order to get the pieces together.
Yeah. I was just wondering how they related to it, or if that, if there was the same type of struggle with them that you're...
No, none whatsoever. That's what I'm saying. The biggest struggle I had was when I was in St. Louis, and I had written those pieces in the early 70s. One you played earlier, Movement Equals Creation, even though it was recorded in 75, it was written around 71. And when I performed it in St. Louis, I had a problem. But after coming to New York, no problem.
Living in New York... I imagine there's so many things going on there. There's so many different musical scenes. It's a lot of new wave music there. There's a loft scene. There are a lot of different influences.
Mm-hmm.
Did moving to New York have an effect on you because of that mix?
Definitely. Anyone who moves to New York is going to have an effect on you. I don't care what field you're in. So, I think the main thing for me moving to New York and in terms of influence was the fact that there's so many talented people there, and you're kind of immediately in competition with them. And I think it's a positive kind of competition, and it makes you perform, it makes you produce, it makes you create. I mean, to be in that environment, if you can keep all of the other things together, other things being health and place to stay and all of the, you know, New York can be very cruel to you sometimes.
Yeah, what's the survival, the difference in survival there from St. Louis?
Oh, well, you know, you have to go get it in New York.
Does that influence your music?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, your environment is going to influence the music. I found that when I got to New York, I realized that things were endless, limitless, the possibilities there, because... you can be so creative in New York and survive. I mean, it's the only place that you can do that. I mean, you can beg. You can be a beggar on the street and survive in New York. You can't do. I couldn't do that in St. Louis. Not that I would do that, but I could play my horn on the streets every day and survive in New York. I mean, you can't do that in small cities in the Midwest. So New York is a fantastic place. I mean, it leads to anything you want to do. You can do it if you have the drive and go and get it.
The band you're playing with tonight is called Jump Up, and that's at Haverford at
right.
8 p.m. Can you describe the band?
As you mentioned before, it's two electric guitars, electric bass, drums, and I'm playing saxophone and doing vocals, and guitar players doing vocals also. And we're doing a lot of reggae pieces. We're doing several funk-oriented pieces, funk being heavy beat, kind of repetitive thump-thump thing, you know. And but original pieces, you know, original pieces in that vein. And I'm excited about it. I mean, we've been getting a lot of good responses from the group.
To a lot of people, the way you describe funk, a heavy repetitive thump-thump thing, that's how a lot of people would describe it. But then a lot of people would see that, a lot of musicians and listeners would see that as a really negative attribute for music.
Oh, I didn't mean it in that way. That may be true, but for me it's just another vehicle for expressing myself, you know, and it doesn't get in the way, and I didn't mean it in a negative way, actually, because... I mean, it takes quite a bit to get that sound, you know, and to make it and to move with that. So actually, it's very valid. And in the fact of me being involved in the other musical areas that we talked about before, this is just a part of a whole for me, you know, and it feels very good.
How does the funk structure affect your playing? It is repetitive. It's not. It doesn't have the same type of rhythmic space that other types of swing might have in other types of jazz playing.
Mm-hmm.
How does that affect your playing?
In what way? How do you mean affect it? Basically, it's just something that I have dealt with before from my other musical experiences in St. Louis. And so actually, I have to deal within the parameters of that beat that's set up. So, you know. But actually, I can find that I can do a lot of different things that wouldn't ordinarily be done over that. So actually, we don't sound like one of the top 40 groups by any means, you know. We don't have that kind of a sound, but even though we're using some of the elements that they use. You know.
Well, how would you define the difference between yourself and maybe a group, between Jump Up and maybe a group like I don't know, Parliament, or what Stanley Clarke or Herbie Hancock is doing these days, which is also described as funk.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. That would be difficult for me to do because when you say Herbie Hancock and Stanley Clarke, they have, as we talked about earlier, they have a lot of other instruments they're dealing with, synthesizers and all that. We don't have any of these instruments dealing with that. And basically, I think maybe a little looser, you know, a little freer, not free, but freer than mm-hmm. what you than Herbie Hancock or things like that.
Do you listen to other types of funk?
Yes, but not very much, not really. I try not to, so that I can come up with some original sounds, you know. But I can't get away from it, you know. Actually, because anytime you turn on the radio, you're gonna hear something, you know.
We've been talking throughout the interview I ask, how do you feel about this category? And you say, we do need labels. Labels have their purpose, but it's really part of a whole for me.
Mm-hmm.
But let me ask you about the category of music you'll be playing tonight, the funk-oriented sound of Jump Up. How committed are you to playing that on an ongoing basis? What I mean is, you think it's something you're going to be doing for a long time, or do you feel that, like other things, it's inherently transitional?
It'd be difficult for me to say, you know. It's just something that happened, you know. It wasn't like, okay, now I'm going to do this. It just kind of developed.
Yeah.
And I'm moving with it, you know. And we'll just see where it moves. I really don't know.
I'd like to sort of ask you about how you... feel the public relates to you, the general, you know, whatever that large group mm-hmm. is. You've done many records. I mean, by lots of standards, you've been very successful because you have been able to support yourself playing music. I don't know how easy that is. I mean, it obviously isn't easy.
It's difficult,
but nevertheless, you've been able to support yourself. You've gotten some amount of visibility in the jazz press and in the non-jazz press like Rolling Stone and you're written about and so forth. But do you feel like you're well known or like you're successful?
Yes, successful being in several ways to look at that. Successful meaning that I have a place to stay and I eat every day, and at that point of view, and the fact that I'm doing what I want to do. So I consider that. I consider myself a success from that standpoint. Also, the fact of other musicians who if you start thinking in terms monetarily, other musicians who have monetary successes, I consider that their success my success also. So I can't lose if I keep this attitude, right?
What type of neighborhood do you live in? I'm just curious to find out what your life
is. I live in a New York neighborhood. You know what a New York neighborhood is
like? The mix.
Right.
I'm just wondering how your if your friends are the same people that are your fans.
A lot of my friends are musicians. So my peers, you know, I mean, we hang out, we play, and vice versa. I mean, I have friends who are painters, doctors, you know, all fields. But basically, I would say most of the time I'm with musicians because I'm rehearsing, and when I'm hanging out, I'm with musicians and family, whatever, you know.
Okay, well, you'll be with a group of musicians tonight, Jump Up. And
right. I'd like to mention who's playing in the band. Jerome Harris is playing guitar. Alphonia Timms is playing guitar. Billy Grant is playing bass. Gene Lake is playing drums. And myself.
Anything else you'd like to say about what people might be hearing tonight?
They'll be hearing some good music. And the main thing about the music is just to feel it. If they feel it, we got it. That's it.
Well, it's been nice talking with you. Thanks for coming to Fresh Air today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, let me remind you that Oliver Lake will be playing tonight with his band Jump Up at Haverford College at 8 p.m. in Roberts Hall. And that's on the campus of Haverford College. And for directions or further information, here's a phone number, 896-6606. That's 896-6606. Right now, we're going to hear a final Oliver Lake composition from a record on Black Saint called Holding Together. It's a short but very beautiful piece called Ballad. Ballad, and that was with Oliver Lake, and it also featured Michael Gregory Jackson, who was the composer of that song, and that is from Oliver Lake's album Holding Together on Black Saint Records. And Oliver Lake will be appearing tonight at Haverford College at 8 p.m. in Roberts Hall. It's about 9 minutes to 3 o'clock. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. My name is Danny Miller. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross for the day. And this Saturday, tomorrow night at 11 o'clock, we will be playing, as we do every Saturday evening, Jazz Alive. And tomorrow's Jazz Alive will feature the Clifford Jordan, Barry Harris Quartet, the Tommy Flanagan Duo, and the Art Pepper Quartet. And Art Pepper has been a Fresh Air guest before. He has played in Philadelphia and has also come to talk about his book, Straight Life. Well, last week he was in Washington to discuss his book, Straight Life. He was also appearing at Blues Alley down there. And he talked with Leanne Hansen, who is the co-host of The Weekend, All Things Considered. And this is an interview recorded with Leanne Hansen and Art Pepper.
I was given a gift. I was given a gift in a lot of ways. I was given a gift of being able to endure things, to accept certain things, to be able to accept punishment for things that I did wrong against society, the things that society feels were wrong. And I was able to go to prison. I never informed on anyone. As for music, anything I've done has been something that I've done off the top. I've never studied, never practiced. I'm one of those people, I knew it was there. All I had to do was reach for it. Just do it.
Since he was 17, Art Pepper has been squeezing sound from an alto saxophone, playing with the best, Stan Kenton, Miles Davis, Sonny Stitt, Dizzy Gillespie. In Japan, France, and England, he was voted Jazz Man of the Year. He's done time in San Quentin, spent time in Sinanon. But it seemed no matter what condition the man was in, his horn never failed him. Art Pepper is 55 now, and trying to lead the straight life, on tour, talking about his autobiography, his new album, playing the clubs, trying to lose himself, enjoy himself, and his music.
I still want to please the bartender, like, to where he's going to make money, the waitresses are going to get tips, and the fans are going to like it, they're going to clap. I want them to know me, you know, and, like, to feel me, and to, you know, to love me, you know, if it's at all possible, you know, and I'm doing everything in the world I can do, you know, except to use tricks or to play some, you know, da 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 da, you know, like Illinois Jacquet or something, you know, like to get them. I wish I could forget those things. Heroin did that.
Helped you forget?
Yeah.
Did you think you played better?
No. No, I think I was more relaxed. I mean, I felt better myself. I, you know, if they didn't clap or do anything, I was more conditioned to accepting it, you know, because I closed myself off from them, and that's no good. Mm. So now I've been trying to unclose myself, you know, to the other extreme, like the book. And I say some things in the book that I'm sure people must read and say, oh, my God, boy, what a monster he must have been. Yeah.
I did that.
Yeah.
You scared me.
Yeah, I know. I've had people that don't like jazz and read the book and wouldn't review it, stopped reading it because they couldn't stand it, like a couple of women did that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy gave them an album of mine and said, take the album home and listen to it, you know. And they heard Patricia on Art Pepper Today on Galaxy and came back and said, the beauty, like anybody that can play that pretty, you know, can't be all bad.
Do you still have to get fortified to play before an audience?
No. No, it's like my last big battle is alcohol, and I have cirrhosis, you know, among all kinds of other things, and When I'm at home, I never have even a thought. It's the most farthest thing from my mind is to have a drink. And when I get into a bar and, I play the first set and all of a sudden, after a certain point, I'm watching all these people, like, drinking and, and being loaded and everything. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm not in the same thing. I'm in a different world right now than they are, So I have a drink and... Right at the very first, it seems, yeah, this is it. And then all of a sudden, I start really getting separated, And then I see how bad I feel the next day, and my wife gets mad at me. And so it's the last thing that I've got to conquer. It's just, it doesn't help. When I'm sober, I play better, and I'm more able to reach the people. There's no question about that. So I've done just about everything that I've wanted to do, the book, and now the record, if the record sells, that'll be great. If the book is made into a movie, that'll be great. But I'm afraid that, that neither one of those things are going to happen.
What happens if it doesn't?
Then, the book is my entire life. The string album is I'm playing like me. I have my own thing, my own style, everything. And what do I do? What do you do after you've given everything that you can give, Mm-hmm. And, I don't know what to, there's no more goals, and without goals, it's
No more musical goals.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to be thought of by everyone as the greatest saxophone player that ever lived.
You always wanted that.
Yeah, and I will never stop wanting it. And sometimes when I play, I feel that I am.
Art Pepper spoke with Leanne Hansen, the co-host of Weekend All Things Considered, and Art Pepper's biography, Straight Life, is published by Shermer Press. And Art Pepper will be one of the featured players tomorrow night on Jazz Alive, which is heard every Saturday night at 11 p.m. on WUHY. Right now, let's listen to a composition Art Pepper wrote. It's called Nutmeg, and the title is dedicated to a nutmeg mixture, which at one point Art Pepper was concocting. He wrote about that in his book, Straight Life. And from the Savoy Reissue series, this is Art Pepper. Thank you. Recorded in 1954, that was Art Pepper playing alto, and by the way, Jack Montrose playing tenor sax, playing an Art Pepper composition called Nutmeg. And Art Pepper will be one of the featured artists on this Saturday's Jazz Alive, tomorrow at 11 p.m. Also playing on Jazz Alive will be the Clifford Jordan Barry Harris Quartet and the Tommy Flanagan Duo. It's about 2 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. And coming up at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air, we'll hear part two of a special music workshop and concert which Jackie Byard recorded with Terry Gross about a year ago. And we heard part one of that yesterday, part two coming up today at 4. And then every Friday at about 3:30, we're joined by Bill Van Word, who reviews a film and discusses the upcoming week of movies to be shown on television. The film Bill's going to talk about this week is Excalibur. Right now, we're about to hear an interview with Charles Higham, who is the biographer of Errol Flynn, among many other biographies. Hollywood, still in the movie-making capital of the United States and the world, possesses the most massive and effective star-making machinery of our time. It is, after all, just people, some of who are incredibly talented and some who possess the more superficial qualities of talent and stardom, who are projected on the silver screen and become figures with whom we become very involved, both as movie characters and as personalities off the movie screen. Perhaps the nature of the type of movie star or anti-star is different today from what it was in the past decades, but they're still stars nevertheless. Movie stars are a little bit like politicians or other public figures in that there's a part of us in the audience which reacts strongly when an image is shattered or when, for better or worse, accurately or inaccurately, something is exposed or the truth comes out. Many times in the form of sensational headlines, which are later exposed themselves as not being truthful, as in the recent Carol Burnett case with the National Enquirer. And public figures, especially movie stars for better or worse, have to contend with their personal lives becoming matters of public interest because of their celebrity status. Recently, I did have the opportunity to speak with Charles Higham, whose job it has been to cover the lives of those who live and work in Hollywood as the Hollywood correspondent to the New York Times for over 10 years. He's recently resigned that position but still contributes to the Times frequently. Born in London, Charles Higham came to Hollywood in 1969 and since then has interviewed over 200 stars, cameramen, and directors and wrote many biographies, including those on Marlene Dietrich, Katharine Hepburn, and Charles Laughton. The biography which has gained the most attention is his most recent one on Errol Flynn, titled Errol Flynn, The Untold Story. The untold part of the title refers to the many things which Charles Higham wrote about Errol Flynn, best known as the dashing, handsome devil type whose roles included Captain Blood, Robin Hood, and many other adventure and patriotic heroes. The untold part revealed Errol Flynn as an alcoholic, a drug abuser, a compulsive liar, a bisexual, and most shocking, a Nazi collaborator and sympathizer, having befriended a German physician who belonged to a Nazi spy ring and intervening on his behalf to gain him entry into the United States and other countries. Charges of libel which were brought against Charles Higham by Errol Flynn's family since the publication of his book have since been dropped. Before I spoke with Charles Higham about his recent book on Errol Flynn, I asked him to describe how he would approach his work with the New York Times during the 10 years he was the Times Hollywood correspondent.
I would try to read everything that had ever been in print about that star that I was going to interview so that I was completely briefed on the subject. I would then, as it were, put it all away in my back pocket and sit down with the star in the most informal manner possible and talk to them as though I had always known them. Not for any evil underlying purpose of catching them off guard, but simply because I was very anxious to discover what they were really like beyond all the flim-flam of Hollywood. I also made it an absolutely mandatory rule that the interview would be conducted at their home, because even if the house had been done by a decorator, which is true in an unhappily large percentage of Hollywood houses, even that would give me a clue to the personality of the owner. And there would be odd telltale details of that house that would perhaps disclose that it was a cover for the star, that it wasn't quite the way they really were.
Are there any houses that particularly struck you in that way?
Yes. Well, the first interview I ever did for the New York Times was with Robert Young, who had a lifelong struggle with alcoholism. His extremely neurotic, delicate, fragile personality was very much the opposite of Marcus Welby, who, of course, symbolized wholesome good cheer and house calls unheard of in California, as indeed elsewhere in the United States, unfortunately. So that you were dealing with someone who acted out a role. I found him exceedingly nervous. His house, a Norman Rockwell interior of rubbed brassware, family portraits, chintz chairs and curtains. In other words, something most carefully designed to disguise the agony which inhabited that house.